Welcome to yet another episode of Shortcast Over Coffee. Today, my guest is Rafi Krikorian. Rafi has had a distinguished career in tech, a career most would dream of. He graduated from MIT and went on to work in senior leadership positions at Twitter and Uber. He was the senior director of engineering at Uber's Advanced Technologies Center and the first ever chief technology officer of the Democratic National Committee. Rafi is currently serving as the Chief Technology Officer of Emerson Collective, where he works on developing opportunities and solutions in education, environment, immigrations, and many more pressing problems in the world today. Check out Rafi's work at www.emersoncollective.com and do check out his podcast on technology and governance, Technically Optimistic, wherever you get your podcast. In this episode, I talked to him about his days at Twitter and Uber, his days with the Democratic National Committee, and his thoughts on ethics and policymaking around artificial intelligence. Please do like, share, and subscribe this podcast, Shortcast Over Coffee, on top podcast platforms like Spotify, Apple, etc. Now, without further ado, let's dive right in.
Hi, Rafi. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome. You have done so much work in the field of tech and AI, and now in the field of, you know, social tech for social good, if I can call it that, with Emerson Collective. But I want to take you back to your time before Twitter, you know, your time at MIT.
Sure.
How did MIT shape your outlook towards the world or towards technology in general?
I mean, that's a great question. Now I'm feeling super old. MIT really teaches you a few things. One is it teaches you how to learn. Like, I think a lot of people come to MIT being like the best in their high schools or the best where they came from, and you rapidly are shown you are no longer the best. Like, it's just not a thing anymore. And so, like, you have to a lot of people who come to MIT spend a lot of their high school and previous careers, like, not working very hard, frankly, or like not working very hard on academics, but working hard on other stuff, because academics just came easy or natural to them. And so, like, MIT kicks your butt. Like, you have to learn how to learn again. And so, like, that's one of the things you have to do. But the second is that it's an amazing network of people who are like dreamers, who are thinkers, who are imaginers, like, who are doers. I'm like, that's the real thing you get out of MIT. It's like being around people who like push and challenge and just try things and like don't kind of take no for an answer. I mean, like, so I was really fortunate that, well, one, I was fortunate to go to MIT, but two, I was really fortunate that at MIT, my undergraduate advisor was a gentleman named Mike Hawley, who sadly has passed away, at the MIT Media Lab. And so, like, he showed me, or as part of his freshman seminar, like, he just asked the most absurd questions you could think about. Like, should we put GPS, consumer GPS was just coming out around the time I went to college. Like, what happens if we strap GPS to rollerblades? So we did. Like, and so, like, we rollerblade around the city with a cell modem and would live transmit our location back. And then we could build apps on top of it. Disney saw that. It was the basis of, like, some of their tours of walking around Disneyland. And we asked questions just like, what happens if we try to, like, ship a person using FedEx to Bali? That turns out to be a bad idea, but like it just like made you rethink just like what global shipping networks look like and how we can think about that. And so like my experience with the Media Lab just taught me on how we should learn to tell stories, like re-question all the things that are possible or impossible. Like, yes, you could build a trebuchet in the weekend and launch a refrigerator. Like, there's no reason you can't. Like, you just have to choose to do it. So like that's, I think, like the thing I took away the most from MIT is just like, just a redefinition of what's possible.
Yeah. I mean, I like the way you mention about it, because, you know, a lot of the times we are in this, mundane life where we don't think out of the box.
Yeah.
I feel like MIT, you know, teaches you to do just that. And a lot of people also ask me that, hey, you know, you're working on something entirely different from what you did your PhD in.
Yeah.
And I tell them that, you know, PhD, you know, teaches you to learn. I think that's yep. fundamentally what it helps you do. Wow, that's a fantastic description of how or what makes MIT different from probably a lot of the other schools. So that's great. So post MIT, you work your way up and you land in Twitter. And I actually read one of your interviews where you said that when you quit Twitter, you said that you quit your job for two reasons. First, I was tired. Second, I did everything that I had set out to do. You know, Twitter has been, well, X now has been in the news for a lot of reasons. But what were those first? I think you were the 50th employee of Twitter, right?
Give or take, yeah.
Yeah. How were the first few days of Twitter like?
I mean, when I was interviewing for jobs, I mean, I was leaving MIT. I left MIT. I started a consulting company. I'd gotten married, and my wife was taking a postdoc position at Cal Berkeley. So sold the consulting company. We're moving west. And I interviewed with a whole bunch of companies. I won't bother naming them all, but all the big brands. And the Twitter folks were just the most fun and interesting to hang out with in the grand scheme of things. Like, everyone was building important things. I'm not going to dispute that. But the Twitter folks were interesting, were exciting, were just fun. And because like they were so mission-driven on what we're doing, they had just come through Arab Spring-like things. So like they were seeing like calls of like, we could take on governments by this technology. Like there was this metaphor going around of like, we could flatten the world so anyone can talk to anyone. That turns out many issues with that problem with that, but there's a level of like optimism and excitement about the kind of stuff that we do. And at the scale of Twitter at the time, like every single person actually really mattered. Like they would do something that like would impact all these users. I remember the first time I took down the site because I made a mistake, like all these people lost access to Twitter because I made a mistake in my code, or the first time I pushed a new feature and I was so excited, like millions, hundreds of millions of people would be able to see the stuff that I pushed. So like that was the early days of like just like this raw excitement of like we could actually like help and change and make a difference in the world in some way.
Yeah, I was looking at daily active users of various social media networks, social media sites, and Twitter is nowhere to be seen in the top, I don't know, probably top 10. It's probably lying somewhere there. But it has nothing to compete with the numbers of TikTok or Facebook or Instagram. But the fact that Twitter has been relevant for so many years speaks a lot about you know, the vision that the founders had or the vision that the early employees had. Seeing Twitter or X now, what are your thoughts on how much of a deviation has happened from when you first started there?
Yeah, I mean, like, there's a reason why I still call it Twitter and I don't call it X, right? Like there's like an emotional thing which gets triggered when you start calling it X. I mean, look, I mean, like the soul of what was that product is now completely gone. Like there are so many things that we used to talk about, which are just not true anymore. Of like, you know, we used to talk about like how constraints breed creativity, like 140, 280 characters allowed people to be super creative on what they did on the platform. And with that constraint gone, like all that's gone. But people used to ask me all the time, like, how hard is Twitter technically? I could build this again with 100 boxes kind of thing, whereas we were using thousands. And I was just like, Twitter is not just a technological problem. Like, it's a social problem. It's the community that's curated. And that community seems to now be gone, like in some ways. Like, we stopped tending to it. And now, like, all the fringe aspects of that community have come in center, and all the people who made Twitter this healthy, thriving ecosystem have sort of, like, faded away into the past or into the background. So, like, you know, like, it's emotionally hard. Like, I've learned to distance myself. Like, I remember when this was all actually going down, it would, like, literally depress me every day. But for me, the trick has just been to not call it X. Like the thing I refer to is the thing it was that just no longer exists in the world. And you just have to be okay with that. I think the sad effect, though, was like, you know, for all its warts, Twitter connected a whole slew of people around the world and created a community. And that community just hasn't come back anywhere, as far as I can tell. Like Portions of went to Mastodon, portions went to Blue Sky, portions went to Threads. Some smaller percentage are on multiple of these, but like there's just no more of that critical mass of people in any single place anymore. And that also seems sad in a bunch of ways.
Yeah, we'll have to see how it goes from this point. Rafi, so post Twitter, you moved to Uber, and that is a very interesting time. I think mid 2010s to late 2010s or 2019, 2018 time was this whole self-driving car thingy, right? And I think you took up a very senior position with Uber ATG. Uber was also experimenting with Uber Elevate, the electric, probably self-driving airplane. And now a lot of companies like, for instance, Argo AI comes to mind, have wrapped up their business.
Sure.
What is the gap that, you know, that you identified at that time, and why are a lot of businesses rolling back on self-driving car technology?
No, it's a great question. I think that let me answer it in a slightly different way. I think the reason why Uber took on self-driving cars is not because we wanted to build a self-driving car. Sure, it's fun. Don't get me wrong. And it'd be amazing if we pulled it off. But also that there was a notion that the ride-sharing fleet in general could be enhanced by having some portion of it be self-driving and some portion of it be human-driven. And no one had a self-driving car that Uber could just buy. So we embarked on a path to actually just try to build it. And I remember talking to Travis and others when they were first recruiting me, of just like, well, why now? Like, what? Like, I'm not a robotics expert. Explain it to me like a six-year-old. Like, why now? And there was this convergence of like, compute now got fast enough, compute got small enough, algorithms on vision, LiDAR, merging all these sensor data were getting better. It's been proven that a bunch of these technologies could work in a military sense, off-road, on-road, etc. And like, you know, there was a real opportunity and timing to try to get it on the road in a commercial sense. I think what we all misestimated, honestly, was the number of insane edge cases there are when actually driving on roads. And like, it was a vast underestimation of that. Turns out driving on highways is kind of straightforward. And so like, but you can't extrapolate from driving on highways to driving on public non-highway roads. And so like, when we actually got into the real nitty gritty of it and just like work through every single edge case, or honestly, you couldn't even think about every edge case. So it was sort of like approaching edge cases, like we got the car on the road, we saw what stopped the car and we started fixing it. And then once we fixed it, we got the car back on the road, something else stopped it and we had to like fix that. And just sort of like that grind, I think that like we A, underestimated, and B, we had no good sophisticated engineering, computer science, algorithmic abilities to like make a discontinuous jump to get across all these cases. And so like we were just dealing with them on a case by case basis. Now, at the same time, like, you know, it's been years since I was doing this, like deep learned models and on other fully, truly data driven approaches might have a chance to get us across these humps, but you know, it's still left to be seen. Like, you know, the people who have some of the best data in the world in this space is probably Tesla, and Tesla can't even drive on the road just yet. Some of these other people like Waymo, Argo, etc., Waymo and Cruise, you know, they were riding in San Francisco, and it seemingly were doing pretty well. But again, you know, in very restricted neighborhoods, not in like a general case driving situation. So like approaching like, you know, there's some pun to be made between AGI and general purpose driving. I don't know what it is yet, but like trying to get to that AGI of driving, it's going to take us a while. So like it's a question of more like these days, and you know, yes, Argo and others have failed, but those who are successful are like figuring out how to constrain the problem space a lot more. Like we only do semis on highways, or we only do semis on highways between Houston and Dallas, or we only do passenger carrying in retirement communities. Like they're starting to figure out ways to carve the space up to give them a better chance to hit that goal. So I think when you ask what the gap is like some real algorithmic intelligence that we just don't have yet. And this true underestimation of the state space that you had to like go through in order to get a driver to generally drive on the road.
Yeah, I think constraining these driving spaces, like you mentioned, is still a good start because, you know, when I think about it, cars are laying in the parking lot for, I don't know, 23 hours of a day.
Exactly.
Maybe running them like Southwest Airlines is the way to go because, you know, you can get more out of them.
I mean, it's not just even running the cars. Like, I mean, the fact that actually sold me into sort of joining or taking on Uber self-driving was that, you know, some decent percentage of modern cities is dedicated to parking, like, and some absurd number, like double digit percentages is dedicated to parking. And like, we live in places that like don't have enough housing or don't have enough green space or don't have all this stuff. If we can get rid of parking, that would fundamentally change it. So like, you know, does that get solved through personal self-driving cars or do we need to make self-driving minivans or self-driving buses? Like, I don't know exactly the answer there. And there's a lot of cases to be made on all three of those, but getting rid of just the place to park these cars would be a game changer.
Yeah. Yeah. I know with Emerson Collective, some of your interests are in, you know, immigration, climate change, etc. And that leads me to the question about reimagining cities. I know Google had this moonshot project called, I think it was called Streetwalk or something. They rolled it back.
Sidewalk Labs, maybe.
I think it was called Sidewalk Labs. Yeah, that's right. So do you think now if we are building communities or cities in the future, we need to think about reimagining how they are built? I think in Silicon Valley, there is a lot of thrust on, you know, not letting it grow past a point. I actually watched an Instagram reel of someone talking about, hey, there is all the space between Highway 280 and the coast that is just lying there. You know, why don't we have more construction? I'm like, that is supposed to be there. I mean,
there's like a whole bunch of campaigns and ballot initiatives to make sure that that stays green. Like, in fact, there are laws that prevent you from having billboards on the 280 side to preserve that green space. But I mean, to answer your question, Nick, absolutely, we need to fundamentally change the way that we build cities. Like, one of the people I'm fortunate to work with or work nearby or help work out is like a guy named Kent Larson over at MIT Media Lab. And like, Kent really thinks about what the future of cities should look like. And I fully buy in this model. Like, he's done all this analysis of just like inflow and outflow of cities. He's comes up with different models of like what a healthy city looks like. What's the right mix of urban, commercial, residential, and industrial mixtures. Like, he built like SimCity like models that help you put it together and evaluate the healthiness of these cities, walking distance, like what percentage of jobs are nearby and things like that. And like, unsurprisingly, American cities don't do well on any of these metrics. European cities do way better. I mean, like, Paris has a whole, like, was it 10-minute city or 15-minute city framework of just like, you should be able to walk and get everything you need in daily life with a 15-minute walk from where you live. And so like, Kant has taken inspirations like that and like, how do we quantify them so it's not just a philosophical thing that some like person 100 years ago decided, and actually make this into something that real urban planners today can use? And so, yeah, we need to change our cities. Like, Americans spend too much time in their cars. Like, we don't spend enough time. Like, even I live in a fairly bikeable place and I don't bike enough. Like, I should be able to bike to my grocery store. I should be able to bike my kids to school. I should be able to walk in the right day. So like, yeah, we need to I think that like, it's also a path to making us all happier. Like, I think this like symbiotic, this relationship with our housing shouldn't just be like, I own a house. It should be like, I own a house and I'm like, I love the community I live in. I provide all the support, things like that. And like, that's the stuff I find super, I'm hopeful for that. That's the stuff I find super exciting.
Yeah. One of the honorable mentions when it comes to making walkable cities, or making cities walkable rather, is Carmel, Indiana. I had the fortune of talking to the mayor of Carmel, Indiana, and he mentioned to me one of the things that, you know, when you're walking from point A to point B, you don't want to be walking through, you know, acres and acres of parking lots. It should not be a walk, but it should be a pleasurable walk. Mm-hmm. And I think what they try to do is put parking underground, build more roundabouts, and not as many traffic lights. So Some cities are making a move, but a long
I mean,
way
if
to
you
go.
walk through Greenwich Village in New York, right, it's super cool. Like, it's a lot of fun. Walk there during the morning drop-off when parents are bringing their kids around. Walk there in the evenings. It's like buzzing and vibrant. Like, yeah, people would want more space and like some small apartment in Greenwich. I'm sure about that. But like, there's a solution here. Like, we just like, we're smart. We should figure it out.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Rafi, after Uber, you went and took a position in politics, not quite politics, but in tech in politics. And I just wanted to get to know from you, how did working in politics differ from working for tech companies? And what was like the major shift?
Yeah, I mean, like, so yes, I took a job. I was this first CTO for the Democratic National Committee. The Democratic Party is the oldest operating political party on the planet right now. And my job was to think about how to use technology, both like in a defensive and an offensive posture. Like when Tom Perez hired me, I remember his first conversation was just like, so you're going to solve my cybersecurity problem. And he meant that because, in the 2016 election, the Russians hacked the DNC server. So I was like, I mean, sure, yes, I'll solve your cybersecurity problem. But solving cybersecurity is a path to not losing. It's not a path to winning. And so like we spent years working together to try to upgrade the infrastructure of the Democrats to make it possible that we can campaign more efficiently, effectively, talk to voters on the language they want to hear on the issues they care about. And so I did all that. Now, all the white hair on my beard is from my time at the Democratic Party. Like, that is probably the hardest job I ever had, was being CTO there, which is kind of crazy when you think I used to build self-driving cars and do all these things. But the thing about being as part of a Democratic Party or being part of a political party is that, you know, at Uber, I ran a 1,000-person team, like 1,000 people reported into me so we can get these cars on the road. At Twitter, I ran a 500-person engineering team. So like all these people report to me to try to get Twitter be functional, performant, etc. At the DNC, there were 4 people when I joined, me included, on the technology group. And one of them was an IT person. And so like, I needed to create a whole cultural transformation that data and technology was important. And then B, I need to set off a chain of events because there's just a realization that you don't make an organization technologically literate in a year. Like, this is a decades long thing. So I need to figure out how to set off a chain of events that would like live past me being there. Now, the problem is that people hate change. People have built structures built power structures based on the way things are. And when you're a change agent trying to make change happen, you get like an immune response. Like, people immediately try to push back against you. And so like, my job was to ask all these tough questions of just like, why is it that the Democrats sell their data? Or why is it that like technology needs to have permission by the following people? Or why is it that like there are structures in place to prevent some candidates from getting access, but not other candidates, which immediately triggered like literally one of the, and also another problem before I get to that story, another problem is that I had 4 people reporting to me and the job was to be influential, but maybe not have reporting. And so literally at one point, one of the executive directors of one of the state parties must have convinced a local newspaper to put a hit piece on me, trying to get me fired from my job because I was trying to change so many things inside the DNC. Thankfully, I didn't get fired. Thankfully, Tom Perez, who was my boss, believed in the work I did to help protect me to really get this ball rolling. And I think that like, I think it was that is the most challenging. It's like trying to understand what really are your levers at play when you're trying to change a really old institution. How do you speak to people who currently hold pieces of power and convince them that there's a different way to do things? And then how do you set up this institution, which thankfully I think we did, to be on a path to having technology as core. Like when I joined, there were four of us. But now the DNC tech team is still literally, there's been two people after me as CTOs, the largest team in the building. Like technology is literally the biggest investment that the Democrats make at any given time at the committee. And it seems like it's going to go like that for a while. So, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I can totally imagine with 500 people reporting under you at Twitter, 1,000 at Uber, you know, there is a certain sync, right? Because everyone working for these companies is a techie, but moving into a completely different space. I mean, we all see the congressional hearing of, you know, TikTok or Google, and the kind of questions that are asked in forums like that is pretty, you know, I don't know, laughable.
Mind-numbing.
Mind-numbing, yeah. So communicating, and I think this is part of the reason why, you know, technology goes leaps and bounds, but policies fail to catch up, is because of this lack of communication, of lack or lack of awareness of politicians in general. Do you think communication was one of the toughest things to do?
Yeah, I mean, like, I'll go in defense of these politicians for half a second. Like, I remember being at the DNC when the first Mark Zuckerberg hearing happened. And to our collective point, like, the questions that were being asked from the bench to the CEO of Facebook were mind-numbingly stupid. Like, they're just bad questions. I've had the privilege recently to testify in front of Congress, and I've been watching, obviously, the testimonies around AI and others. The questions have gotten a lot better. So, like, I think it feels like the representatives and the senators are now realizing they need better talent and staff on their teams. So, like, that's a good thing. But you're right. Like, I mean, in a lot of ways, these are fundamentally communication problems. And also, I mean, I'm not going to say they're only communication problem, but communication is definitely part of the problem and how all these things get connected. People work together, ideas flow through. But like, I'm being optimistic right now that I think like things are getting better, but that's on one particular topic, right? It's like on AI and data. Like, can we stay in front of all these other emerging technologies that come up? Who knows? Like, it might be the next level of dumb questions again as we go through that.
Yeah. And I see some welcome change, like the executive order that the Biden administration put out last year had a significant mention of, you know, blueprints created by Brown University professors and things like that. So I think there is some shift, but hopefully things get better. Rafi, one of the things that you focus on in your role at Emerson Collective is immigration, from what I understand, and I think I heard you mention in one of your interviews that your wife is a professor at Stanford, and she gets to hear a lot about international talent, extremely skilled international talent, you know, finding it difficult to find positions of their job, find positions of their choice because of the immigration rule. You know, there is an AI race or a tech race going on between US and China and many other countries, I'm sure. But how does a country like the US, which wants to lead the AI race, keep up with this need for talent?
I mean, I think this is fundamentally an immigration issue. I think that, like, we admit all these students right now because we believe they're good enough to the top universities. I mean, the top universities in the US are kind of the top universities in the world. So, like, we admit all these students from all around the world to go study at Stanford, MIT, CMU, Berkeley. But we don't provide an easy path for them to stay in this country. That is bonkers. Like, that is like one of the craziest things I've ever heard. And so, like, just even fixing that would give us this massive leapfrog in a couple of years. I put this on my newsletter a few weeks ago. I write a newsletter on Technically Optimistic in preparation for season two. But one of the links from a few weeks ago is literally the story of, I believe it was Stanford, but I could be wrong in the school, but let's say Stanford student who couldn't find a job in the US. He was a wireless expert, did all this work and research in wireless. And then had to go, not had to go, but like returned home and took jobs in other countries, like whether it was India or China, etc., and developed 5G. So 5G for a while was basically owned by the Chinese companies, sort of like building the, all the technologies that powered it. And just imagine if he could have just found a job here in the States. So the fact that we're not allowing, like, some of the best talent is willing to come here and we don't give them a way to stay is so crazy. Like, put aside all your other feelings about immigration and whether people across the border should get asylum and all that stuff. I'm happy to talk about that at length. I'll put my politics on my sleeve, but just the high caliber talent that's willing to come here to study, we should figure out ways for them to stay here and contribute to this country. And like, that's that, we just need to fix that. Like, it's just so broken.
Yeah. This is a great segue to our conversation that we spoke about AI. You know, I've heard Alex Karp talk at length about how technology should be for the greater good of the world, and I'm paraphrasing here, for the greater good of the world, technology should be in the hands of the West. This is his comment, but given the fact that, you know, AGI or AI in general has gone leaps and bounds in countries like the US, and I think India is coming up with its own native AI model, that's been the case. But do you think it is important that it needs to be with the West, or are you more of like an open source person like Mark?
I'm definitely more of an open source person, but I think you can have open source and still do massive investments that push the ball forward for your country. And so like, I fundamentally believe in open science. I fundamentally believe in open source. And I think that like the pros outweigh the cons, not saying there are no cons, but like anyone who says there are no cons to open source is naive. Like there are obviously cons, but I feel like the pros vastly outweigh the cons here. And I think that like, you know, the French are doing this experiment right now where because they have one AI company right now, or one decent sized AI company right now. But before that, they were doing all these investments in open source AI because that was their way of feeling that they could stay competitive as a country basis. And because of that, perhaps now they actually have like an open, like a company that's focused on it. So I feel that like open source allows us to have decentralization of power and ideas, which therefore allows for more innovation to occur in the space. It provides us some ways for us to like as a society have more understanding of what's really going on in these like very complex systems. Yes, it might still be a few people today that can understand it, but hopefully by tomorrow and the day after, more and more people have opportunities to understand these type of technologies. And I think that like, yes, there are serious cons involved, but I think governmental investment of things like, can we do things to like solve the infrastructure problems so that these people can continue to do their work? Can we solve data access issues so that we can really train these things and push them forward? I feel like we can be leaders in not just like actual implementations, but also like trains of thought and philosophy that will cause talent to want to come here and work here in the States. I feel like all these are related. But like, I think that like doing investments, fixing immigration, sponsoring open source, I think are ways to like try to get more and more people to come here. Because like, yeah, you can work on open source in a distributed way easily, but everyone, I think a lot of people would realize that like concentrated talent gets way more stuff done. So like, you know, that's why people like could work anywhere, but they're moving to work at OpenAI. They move to work at Meta. They move to work at all these organizations. So I think that like investments, open source, and like concentrating these like talent and fixing immigration are like really a path for our country, for this country to sort of like continue to keep our advantage over everyone else. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that the West will have access to this. Our West will be in front. But I think that like we can maintain that by sort of like doing a bunch of different things. Now, there is a good question of just like, there's technological stuff that we want the West maybe to hold on. But I think there are like a societal questions that we should look through the rest of the world or the entire world to see how to answer. So like, you know, I've been friends with a person who runs this organization called Karya that does a bunch of data training in India and uses data training as a way to lift people out of poverty. Like, there are solutions like that that are coming from like the global south that the entire world should learn about. So like, I'm a huge fan of like trying to cast the net as wide as we can, looking for interesting solutions, innovative solutions, things that we should learn, and then sort of like bringing them and sort of like curating the best out of them.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, this is this could be a bit of sidetrack, but you mentioned about this data entry roles in India. I sometimes think that the ChatGPT model, which has been trained on, you know, millions and millions of tokens and data generated by many, many, many users over the years, they don't get any credit for the kind of stuff that they have generated over the years. Whereas, for instance, I'm sure with your work at Uber, you would have had people to, you know, label things. So that is different because they are paid for the kind of value addition that they do. Getting trained on general data from Reddit or the internet is not compensated. So how do you see that?
Yeah, we actually, again, we talk about this in my upcoming season of the podcast of like, we need to have a fundamentally different economic model. And so like, and you know, maybe we've lost the battle on stuff that's already been published out there in the world, stuff that's already, and so like that stuff, you know, under some form of licensing agreement or some form of like, some form of just like fair use clauses that these might just be a thing. But like sort of moving forward, we need to redefine what it means to collect these data sets and figure out how to compensate the people that generated them. So that's why I like things like Karya. So like, let me just like recap. So like what Karya does is an acknowledgement that there are a lot of languages in the global south, and India in particular, that are spoken by millions of people, but they're not English. So that means that there are not a Western language. So it means that the amount of effort being spent to create the data sets needed are not as large. So what Manu did, the founder, is he created a very small app, very simple to use, and went into rural India to find people, usually women, who speak these marginalized languages and get them to train an AI system on these languages. And he sells this data to literally the Microsofts, the open AIs of the world, and puts 85, 90% of the profits into the women's hands. And so like it literally raises these women out of poverty and their families out of poverty over the global poverty line by doing simple data collection. And he gives the license to the data. The owner of the data license is the woman, or is the person who created it. So he's also trying to fundamentally invert how all this works. So like they can choose to revoke their data from these systems at any point if they really wanted to. So I think like we need models that maybe not this exact model, but we need different models on how to compensate people. So like, I know right now OpenAI is trying to make deals with a whole bunch of publishers to try to get access to a whole bunch of like text so that they won't be potentially sued later. Like, can they start making the deals now? We need to start thinking about like how all this new content that you and I generate, like what's the license of your podcast when it gets ingested by one of these models? So we need to like start working through all of these. There are not simple answers, but like if we don't start today, it will take us longer to answer them. So like we need to start today on really figuring out like what we need to do here. But like the economic or the compensation model here clearly needs to change.
Yeah, and we all saw what happened with the screenwriters in Hollywood, right? I think you did an excellent episode on that on Technically Optimist.
Well, I mean, The frustrating thing is just like you get into these crazy cycles with some of these companies who want to train these data, saying like, well, we can't afford to pay the data. I'm just like, well, you're also projecting trillions of dollars of revenue. Like, what do you mean you can't afford it? Like, we just need to have like an honest conversation about just like the economic both benefits to you and then the benefits to all that help you, and just like make sure that all works out.
Yeah, So that brings me to the question that, you know, AI, which is a very recent phenomena, and like I mentioned before, it's growing leaps and bounds, and so fast that it's extremely difficult to keep up. And we had so many technological pivots over the past 50 years, like the internet, telecommunications, etc. And the policies could keep up. What is it about AI that makes it extremely difficult for policies to keep up? And there just seems to be so much of noise around policy on AI, but nobody is able to, you know, fix it and bring it to a closure.
Here's another way to think about it. I think you're right. I think that most technological changes over the last some time period have all proceeded through the same cycle. Like, you can think about this from the loom, the printing press, recombinant DNA, whatever you want to say, of just like they go through some hype cycle of like everyone is super excited by it. Then we go through some cycle of scared and fear of just like this is going to destroy jobs, it's going to destroy the world. And then we sort of like come down to like a normalized, like fades back into the background. It's like now it's a normal part of everyday life. And society both catches up on like understanding it, or at least for themselves, regulators catch up and understanding it, at least for themselves. And, you know, there might've been some job loss, but like net job gain, frankly, and some like maybe movement on the on like what the actual jobs are, but net job gain. The thing that's different around this time, everything I just said is still true on AI, except it's moving so fast. And I think that there's an honest question right now, like, can that last step of like absorbing into our society, can that happen at the pace that AI is changing? Or are we sort of like in an escape trajectory situation when it comes to AI? And I don't know the answer to that, but I think that that is the unique thing that's different. Like, I often say in conversation that we're stuck in this world where like our 20th century ideas are colliding into 21st tech, which is rapidly becoming 22nd century tech. Like, it's like we're on this exponential curve. Humans are really bad at exponential. So like we are having trouble seeing what we think is 3 years away might actually be next year. What we think is a decade away might be only 2 years away, kind of thing. We're really bad at that. And so what hope do we have really in that world is the question. And I think we need to like step back and not talk about the actual specifics. Like, we can't be regulating this type of technology looking at the problems we're facing right now, because that's by definition backwards looking. We need to instead start thinking about frameworks and guardrails of like what we want to be thinking about in the future. So like your question on compensation might be one of them, of just like we should probably be thinking about a world where people are fairly compensated on training these systems that could, so like, we're not talking about it particularly, it's not about data labeling on self-driving cars, it's not about language, but like we should have a philosophical agreement that people should be compensated for the work that's put into these systems. And so like, let's set that as a guardrail. People should have a choice to understand sort of like decision-making autonomy. Like, is decision-making truly just given over, or do we need to stay in the loop? Do we have a philosophical agreement that like human plus machine is probably better than human or machine? So like, we need to be having those types of conversations to stay ahead of this curve that's coming in front of us. Otherwise, yeah, to your point, we're kind of screwed. Like it's like this stuff is moving too fast. This stuff is actually different than the last times it happened. So like, we need to explicitly be thinking about how to move forward.
Mm. Well, now we are in 2024. It's a big year. It's a big year with US politics, you know, election year coming up. And for someone who wears that politics on their sleeve, how do you think the, you know, if let's say there is a shift in power, let's say Republicans come into power, we all saw that, you know, the Biden administration did take things like climate tech, the CHIPS Act, and also the executive order on AI. I don't see a similar kind of excitement about AI or excitement about AI policy with the Republicans. So how, like, let's say if there is a shift in power in 2024, how would it completely change the direction in which we are headed right now?
It's a great question. And the simple answer is I don't know. But and I don't think anyone does. However, I think that there's a few things that are true. One is like AI seems to be one of the few topics that still enjoys bipartisan conversation. And so like when you say that the Republicans don't, it's like, I don't think that's actually true. It might be true that Donald Trump doesn't care, but yeah. I've spoken to lots of Republican lawmakers, Congress and Senate, who do care. And they care for like honest reasons of just like, they want the best for their communities. They want their best for, and so like, we might disagree on the policy, but at least we're having a reasonable conversation about it. And so like, it's unclear what a Donald Trump presidency might do here, but if we can still maintain some bipartisan conversations of just like, we agree that this is a good thing. We agree that there needs to be some guardrails around it. We agree that like, you know, we can disagree on like how much guardrails we need, but we can agree that there needs to be some. We need to agree on like what frameworks and how we think about it are. Like, you know, I had a really great conversation with a Republican lawmaker about like, how should we evaluate the success of self-driving cars? Like, is it that zero people die in self-driving cars, or just less than humans driving do we kill people in self-driving cars? And like, you know, there are lots of people on both sides of that argument, but at least we're having a reasonable argument about it. And like, these are people from across the aisle arguing about these things. I'm about to go to a congressional offsite in a few weeks to talk about AI, and there will be people from both sides in these conversations. So I'm optimistic that these conversations, if given time and air, can continue. The bigger problem, again, wearing my politics on the sleeve, is I just worry that January 2025 will be in a bad place in this country, regardless of who wins. And so like, we'll have a lot of like countrywide either healing or defending, depending on whose side you're on, that we're going to have to go through before we can just get back to like actually the business of governing. And yeah, that's the bigger concern I have.
Yeah. I mean, when I meant Republican, I actually meant Donald Trump, because I don't see anything from his side. To your point about being optimistic, I think I am optimistic too, because of what happened with the Inflation Reduction Act. People came together on climate and they were like, yeah, there is a problem and we need to work towards it. So we'll have to see what happens with AI. But I feel like this time, 2024, 2025, is sort of like a make or break situation, because if we don't have something soon enough, maybe things can go out of hand. I don't know. So
I don't know. I mean, it's a really great question. Like I said, like, this is the time that's been different than the rest, so which makes it very hard to predict. What I worry about if we don't do something, I worry that, well, on two fronts. On the data front, on the data and privacy front, like, you can't talk about AI without talking about data. On the data and privacy front, I feel like we're in this, like, we might be in a last shot situation of like, everyone I talk to about data and data privacy are just like, how much do you think Google knows about you? Or how much do you think Walmart knows about you? Somewhere between nihilistic and like, just like helplessness. I'm just like, they know everything about me. There's nothing I can do at this point. And like, I don't believe that to be true, but I believe we might be in a last shot to try to turn this around. It's going to take a lot of work. I'm trying to do this right now through my podcast and others. I might fail, but like, I feel like we're in a last shot. On AI, I feel like this stuff is moving so quickly that if we can't at least get some of those like philosophical frameworks and guardrails in place, like I talked about, like people should be compensated, decision-making, that kind of stuff, then yeah, that too, we might be in a last shot to like at least get that in place. So like, I feel like those people who are focusing on short-term regulatory fixes are probably in a losing battle. Because like, you're almost by definition regulating the stuff of the past, and like, we should be spending a lot of our energy on this stuff, because I also don't want to slow it down. Like, it's unclear whether we can slow it down, but like, I want a magical future world where like my kids have personalized tutors. I want all this stuff. And even if I wanted to, I'm not sure I could slow it down. So therefore, we just need to get some of these frameworks in place today before it gets out of control.
Yeah, I think what you said at the end sums up the title of your podcast, Technically Optimistic. I want to know from you, what have been some of your learnings? I see that you have had some excellent conversations with people like, you know, Timnit Gebru. What have been some of the things that opened up your eyes ever since you started hosting a podcast?
Yeah, I mean, like, There is a whole sense of inevitability when it comes around these technologies. So like one thing I've learned is sort of like, these aren't inevitable. Like there are incentives to make you believe they're inevitable. Like whether it be like a company really wants to deploy their technology, so they want you to believe it's inevitable so you don't get in their way and stopping it. None of this stuff is inevitable. Like, so like I've learned that. B, I've learned that people could actually have power. Like, be like, we just need to remember that we're not users. Like the my favorite line is somewhere that like only tech companies and drug dealers call them users. like we're not just users, like we're citizens. Like we actually have the ability to push back. We can send both market forces and electoral forces if we can just figure out how to organize ourselves and remember why we're doing it. So that's number two. But then number three, there's some real questions around like, what is our humanity? Like, I remember some early conversations of like, you know, humans have the ability to anthropomorphize a rock. Like, we literally used to have pet rocks. There's a whole museum in Japan dedicated to rocks that kind of look like people. Like, it's kind of crazy. And now these rocks are talking. Like, they like literally have the power of language. What does that mean about us? Like, if like these systems are quote unquote creative, and we thought creativity was the spark of our souls, does now a machine have a soul? So like those type of questions like still nag at me right now. It's just like, you know, I was talking to a computer scientist. If a LLM can pass the bar effectively, what does that mean lawyers have been doing all these years? Not denigrating my lawyer colleagues, but like, what does that mean about how the human brain works? If like an algorithm can just do it, does that mean like there isn't much going on up here for all of us, not just lawyers? Yeah. So like those three things are like some of my biggest learning / takeaways of all these conversations.
And what do we have for season two?
Yeah, season two is, I used this phrase on you earlier, just like, you can't talk about AI without talking about data. So we're going to talk about where does data come from? And also then, like, similar to AI, like, you have agency in this conversation. Like, how should you be thinking about your data? Like, all these corporations are profiting off your information. They're being used for good things, too, right? Like, the NHS uses data to determine what are right health interventions in the UK. We use traffic data to figure out how cars should move across the world. But at the same time, there's that story from Walmart where, like, a father goes into a Walmart, physical Walmart store, to yell at the Walmart staff, why are you showing my teenage daughter ads about maternal stuff?
Yeah, it was a Target at Minneapolis.
So it turns out that like Target had figured out that through the way the girl was moving through the world, that she was pregnant and she hadn't told her father yet. And that's kind of creepy. And so like, how should we think about the world that we live in these situations where data is being collected, potentially being used to attack us, our own data is being used against us in some ways, criminal justice system is sort of like upended with data. So like, we're going to talk, data is such a huge topic, but we're going to take a few stabs at talking through a few of the pillars so that people can like realize that they can be back in control. We have to get out of this learned helplessness case and we can be back in control.
Hmm. Excellent. Rafi, I also see that you are extremely big on giving back. I know you were born here, but you your ethnicity is Armenian. And you have started this initiative to sort of create more STEM education in countries like Armenia, Albania, etc. Would you like to talk about it more?
Yeah, and
what
I would love
made
to.
You, what made you, you know, think about giving back? And I've always wanted to ask this to people who have achieved or, you know, done something in their life and want to understand or go into their psyche to know what pushes them to give back to the community.
Yeah. So just to be clear, I didn't create the organization that you talk about, TUMO, but I'm on the board of it. And I'm so proud. This is one of the things I'm so proud of, is the work that they do. I mean, I'll tell a very brief story about my grandfather, my mother's father, which was, you know, he was born in the Philippines. People in the Philippines aren't super rich, But he created, after World War II, the first one of the first radio stations on one of the islands in the Philippines, on an island, and then the city was called Cagayan de Oro. And he would host his radio show from the town center. And then he started allowing, so the geography of Cagayan de Oro is at the coast, and then there are steep mountains next to it, and the farmers work on the farmland up there. And they come down during the day to sell their stuff in the market, and they go home at night. And my grandfather allowed the farmers to come on the radio before they went home to basically broadcast to their wives, their families that were coming home, so you can start preparing dinner on my way back. And like that story sticks with me of just like, there's so much that technology can do to unlock and make just our communities better. So that's one thing I think about a lot. The other is like from my Armenian side, look, Armenians have been beat up over like hundreds of years. Like we used to be one of the biggest kingdoms. Now we're relegated to a small country. We had a genocide against us. We had an earthquake that decimated our country. We were under Soviet rule for a while. Like we just lost a bunch of land to the Azerbaijanis. Like 50,000 people had to come over the border to be relocated inside the borders. And so like when I go to Armenia and see the kids, I see myself. I see my kids in all their eyes. And like, Armenia has one thing, which is both like grit, the two things, grit, and like they used to be one of the Soviet centers for excellence when it came to mathematics and physics. And so I'm just like, we need to like re-spark that. Like some of the world chess champions are still Armenians. Some of the teenagers that compete in the World Mathematics Olympiad are Armenians. And so like, if there's a way to spark that and not just like the raw technical talent, but how do we bring creativity? How do we bring out of the box thinking? How do we put this all together? How do we like reform? I fundamentally believe kids are our future. And so just like, can I just spend more time with kids and just give them tools and just see what they do with it? And so like, that's what we do at TUMO. It's so amazing. If you're ever in Armenia, Paris, Lisbon, Zurich, soon LA, just let me know. I will hook you up with a tour. It's mind-blowing when you go inside.
Oh, would love it. Yeah, I remember going to the Armenian neighborhood in LA. It was fascinating to see all the architecture and all of that. I had not planned this question, but you know, now that you speak about your grandfather being in Philippines, like I would love to know how the family made their way to the US.
I mean, it turns out New York City is a magical place. So like my father was born in Syria, grew up in Beirut, and in the 1960s, just chased the American dream and moved to the United States, moved to New York City with working as a jeweler. My mother, born in Manila, just decided she wanted to travel the world. So she was like slowly bouncing her way through the world and doing small jobs whenever she landed to make enough money for the next hop, and found her way to New York City where she was working as a messenger. And she and my dad met one day, and that like New York City does magical things.
Wow, that is so fascinating. I think, I mean, the OG melting pot is
New York exactly. City. That's right.
Well, Rafi, thank you so much for giving me your time. I think great perspectives on AI technology and the future that lies ahead. Thank you so much. It was fantastic talking to you.
A blast. Thank you so much for having me.
Awesome. Take care. Bye.